Welcome to the Sustainable Dish Podcast. I'm Diana Rogers, a real food dietitian living on a working organic farm. I wanted to let you know that I'm hard at work on a new book and documentary film project, Sacred Cow, Why Meat Belongs in a Healthy, Sustainable, and Ethical Diet. Please visit sacredcow.info to learn more and make this happen. I could really use your help, and every tax-deductible contribution makes a big difference. Now on to our show. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. Today, I am so excited to have with me Andrew Smith, who is assistant professor of English and philosophy at Drexel University, and wrote an awesome book that I just finished and I'm so excited about. And we were chatting a little bit before the show. The book is called A Critique of the Moral Defense of Vegetarianism. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
It's a pleasure to be here, Diana.
I loved so many points in your book and want to get into it. I, as I mentioned to you before we got on the show, I took just pages and pages of notes. I just thought you did such a great job, from a philosophy perspective, kind of breaking down and basically illustrating that it's impossible to be vegan or vegetarian, I guess. But I wanted to find out before we get into the book, what motivated you to even take this project on? You mentioned in the book that it started as a blog post, but I'm wondering, so were you vegan or vegetarian before the book came about?
Yeah, I was a vegan, and it, frankly, still am for reasons that we can get into. Still am with air quotes, I should say.
Okay.
But yeah, what motivated it is this blog post of a colleague of who aired this argument that onus should be on meat eaters to defend themselves and their dietary choices, not on vegetarians to defend in this situation past mm-hmm. tense ourselves, and. I read through all of the comments on this, which I don't usually do. And one thing that came up over and over and over again was, that we should privilege vegetarianism over omnivorism because plants aren't sentient. They don't feel pain. And if we want to minimize pain, then we should eat a plant-based diet as opposed to an animal-based diet. Mm-hmm. And occurred to me throughout all this. I've been a vegetarian for half of my life. So 20 some years. And it occurred to me that although I had bought into that idea, I had absolutely no idea what plants' lives were like. I took it for granted that they were just these sort of inert beings in the sense that they didn't feel pain. Mm-hmm. So it became a sort of obsession of mine to figure out if this claim was true. Do plants just not feel any pain? Or do we, in being vegetarians, actually create a more harmless world? Mm-hmm. And when I dug into the science, I found that plants are sentient. And that sounds like a very funny and odd thing to say, but they have all of the characteristics, all of the capacities that animals do. They may not feel what we designate as like an ouch. They may not have that sort of subjective experience, but biochemically, they react in the same way that animals do to being harmed, to being wounded. So that basic defense of vegetarianism broke down. And my initial approach to the book, and this was going to start out being just an article, was to provide a better defense of vegetarianism. And that ended up being chapter two. And the further I got into this, and the more I read, the more the narrative sort of took a turn that I just wasn't expecting. And I got to the point where I had what I thought was a knockdown defense of vegetarianism, except for the fact that one can't be a vegetarian. Mm-hmm. I had a lot more work to do, and the book became far more personal than intellectual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, But you go beyond just the sentience argument in here, and let's describe a little bit deeper the sentient position, though. So, and how exactly plants can communicate, just, I guess, just briefly. But, you know, there's fungal networks underground where they can communicate. They can choose to feed, you know, siblings or offspring. And then above ground, plants can, you know, send out different signals to other plants that, you know, maybe there's a giraffe on the way, you know, coming towards you because I just got nibbled, or there's a certain caterpillar biting me. So as you mentioned in the book, just because they're not talking with language, they're still communicating. And I guess the bigger picture there too is, in one thing that I've noticed with people who are vegetarian, is it's the closer they are to human puts them higher on a quote unquote food chain, right? Like if they have big eyes, like cows, right, have these big eyes, and they look different than a chicken. And so there's some people that will, you know, maybe eat chicken but not beef, right?
Right, yeah. There seem to be two ways that this is defended. On the one hand, there's just the straight up sort of moral sentiment argument that we have a greater affinity for these beings who are more like us, like cows and, of course, our pets, dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other argument, yeah, that these beings feel more. And what we want to do is eat in ways that cause the least amount of suffering. And if we want to cause the least amount of suffering, then we want to choose forms of food that either don't suffer or don't suffer as much. So that gets into questions about whether we should eat shellfish or whether we should eat mollusks, because mm-hmm. they don't have fully developed central nervous systems. And one reason that plants are just immediately ruled out is that they also don't have central nervous systems. But what you find is that they have hormone systems, these biochemical systems, that operate very similarly to our central nervous system. What you get is this idea that if an animal is sort of human enough, then it's our duty not to eat it. And for vegetarians, plants can never be human enough. They have to be what we call ruled as morally inconsiderable. They can't be moral agents or beings who we treat morally. They have to have no moral status, which from my perspective creates all sorts of problems. But it also, the biggest issue is, yeah, that it leads not just vegetarians, but the people of our culture more generally to overlook what plants can do. And, you know, you can think about it in this way. You know, plants have the ability to make decisions, including the patterns in which they grow in order to have the best exposure to sunlight above ground and nutrients below ground. Yes, they can learn, they can teach, they can nurture, they can fight off predators, either themselves or with co-evolutionary reciprocates, symbiotes who they've essentially grown up with, and in response to wounding, they can adapt and change. So what you get here is essentially a picture of beings who simply move far more, their time frame is much different than ours. They move more slowly. And as I say in one part of the book, there's one plant scientist who says, just imagine this, that some aliens from who knows where come to Earth and move in a speed that's far exceeds ours, and they look at us and they see us not moving at all or moving extremely slowly. Would it be acceptable for them, therefore, to exploit us at will because they see us as being inert? Mm-hmm. Well, no, of course not. It would require studying our patterns of behavior within our time frame.
Exactly. Or if they speak to each other telepathically and we don't. And so therefore we're not like them. And so it's okay to eat us. Right.
Yeah. 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 Right. And yeah, just think about it. Yeah. Plants can communicate above ground and below ground. They have extremely complex forms of communication, both above ground and below ground. And, you know, for goodness sake, they make up something like 95% of the biomass on Earth. So to just rule them out and say they don't count, so we can do with them what we want, that creates all kinds of moral and environmental problems.
Yeah, and then zooming out a bit, what I loved was your sort of letting folks know that, well, it really just boils down to what's your worldview, right? Because I've noticed definitely that there are some people that feel that we are here to have control over everything around us. And then there's other folks like me who think that science does definitely have some answers, but that there's just a whole bunch we don't know. And, you know, nature is to be definitely bowed down to and respected. But can you talk a little bit about that, where you talk about the materialism?
Sure. Yeah. Well, just to give a sense of the trajectory of the book, it's really sort of a three-step process. You know, first is to try to provide a more complex version of vegetarianism that takes account of plant sentience and says, if you want to stop here, if you're a vegetarian and you want to just understand the beings who you're making food, here's a way to do it. Here's a way to live by conscientiously if you do that. If you want to go with me a step further, then we want to recognize that sentience itself, as you pointed out earlier, Diana, is a sort of human-centered concept. And to the extent that we focus on giving moral weight to beings like us, we tend to be self-centered in ways that might be harmful to the world around us. Mm-hmm. If we want to take that extra step, then we get into a situation where vegetarianism may be defensible, but only within certain contexts. So you can take that step if you want to with me. And the third step is to suggest that vegetarianism itself doesn't exist, or that one can't be a vegetarian, because looking at ourselves more holistically, or taking this wider view, as you said, and recognizing that we're connected to the world around us through the soil. Soil is this intermediary between beings who eat and beings who are eaten. What we get is a picture of this larger food web in which there are no beings on top or on bottom. We're part of this wider web, and it begins to be senseless to think of, to divide up the world in terms of plants and animals in this thing.
I'm just going to interject. You had this awesome quote that I wrote down. There is no hierarchy, only hunger.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's good.
I love it.
Yeah. And from my perspective, if we set aside this sort of stupid boxing match between omnivorism and vegetarianism and veganism, of course, vegetarianism being for me the sort of wider umbrella term. Mm-hmm. What we get is greater focus on the soil and the beings who make up ecosystems. So my main concern is that we think about eating not in terms of who we eat, but in terms of how we treat who we eat and the ecosystems of which we're both part. Mm-hmm. That's the real issue. In talking about these issues and discussing the book, invariably the focus is on the issue of whether we can be vegetarians or not. And I get that. And I understand why that's of interest to people. But the bigger concern is really focusing on eating sustainably and how we do that. And my deepest concern here is to debunk the assumption that eating sustainably is best done or even requires us to be vegetarians or vegans, because that's simply not the case.
Right. And you also make the point, and we should have said this right in the beginning too, but that it's we're not trying to knock. I mean, being a vegetarian is quite a noble, right? Like not wanting harm, like those are all good things. And we're not arguing that everyone needs to just go out and eat CAFO chicken and factory farmed pork. So that I just wanted to point that out in case we're starting to really make people twitchy.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning this. Yeah, I'm not an industry apologist. I reject industrialized agricultural factory farming in all its forms, not just farming of production of animals, but also production of plants. Both forms are extremely destructive. And you know, if we're to choose between factory farming and eating a plant-based diet, eating a plant-based diet is going to be better in almost every situation. The issue, though, is that the conversation usually stops there.
Right. And then just saying you're not going to eat meat because of factory farming, I could say, well, I'm not going to eat plants because of GMOs. Right?
Yeah.
So there's alternatives to that stuff.
Most definitely. You can look at it historically, you can look at it morally, you can look at it ecologically. And from each of these perspectives, what I came down to is the very simple conclusion that eating in accordance with the dictates of our ecosystems, eating as our land bases require, most certainly is going to lead to different forms of different food traditions. And this is why different areas of the country and different areas of the world have different food traditions. They didn't pop up in meaningless ways. They arose because they're connected with the ecosystems from which they come. And that's why you get, for instance, in tropical areas, much more eating of fruits and vegetables, whereas in more temperate climates or colder climates, most often people have diets that include more meat, because in those climates, in those ecosystems, it simply was not viable until the emergence of a global food system to try to maintain a vegetarian diet, and that's why vegetarianism, for instance, is as a movement, as a food movement, is really only about 40 or 50 years old.
Right. I mean, even just to be able to have the opportunity to push meat away could really only have happened within the last 100 years anyway, because of the availability of food, right? Like we didn't even have the option to say, oh, I don't want to eat meat, you know, when there wasn't enough food to go around, right?
Yeah. You know, I think in very specific circumstances, it was possible. You know, I read some work by 17th and 18th century French, English, German historians who mentioned people who maintained plant-based diets in these climates that made it otherwise very difficult. But metabolically, they would have had to have a fortitude that most people don't. So it wasn't only that they could gain access to certain fats and proteins, for instance, but that they could also survive, and thrive without the dietary requirements that most of their neighbors required.
Mm-hmm. Great. So can you answer my question then with the worldviews? Because I do think that I know it may seem to some folks to be completely off topic, but I think it is exactly the whole crux of the problem of the, at least in my opinion, is sort of this difference between postmodernism, postmaterialism, and materialism.
Yeah. I didn't mean to shirk your question.
It's all right.
Yeah. Although I am a philosophy professor, I have a general aversion to these sorts of terms. And I used it here, more for my fellow professors than the
oh
wider.
no, it was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah, this idea of post-materialism going on the suggestion that when we think about the material in our culture, we generally think of matter as inert, and that it's mind, for instance, that has consciousness, that has thought. And there's an Australian philosopher named Freya Matthews who coined this term post-materialism. And what she's suggesting, and this comes from a long tradition, and I won't bore you about that, she's suggesting that mind and matter are in some ways bound up together, that matter is infused with mind. So what that suggests in the sort of most basic terms is that the world around us has the capacity for sort of consciousness in a certain sort of way. And I don't want to get too deep into it, but what it suggests is that we can have connections with fellow beings in this world that go beyond the linguistic and even beyond the sort of humanly centered that have to do with sort of conscious and thoughtful connection.
Mm. Yeah. Well, what I got out of it maybe is a little bit different, but I kind of saw this as you've got some people, these pre-materialists who believe that, you know, there's a plan for everything, right? That like we're here because there's some plan for us, right? And then you've got these materialists who are feeling that, you know, and this is like a lot of my techie friends I would put in this category, but the sort of folks that think that there's a clever way out of everything, and you can just sort of engineer yourself out. Those are my friends that are drinking the Soylent and, you know, just trying to figure out a new way to, you know, control the weather or control reality. Actually, these are my friends that are working in the virtual reality world. And then we've got these other folks that I might put myself in where, you know, there's just too much left to that is not yet explained, that we can't understand yet. Anyway,
yeah,
that was my sum of what you said there, but I could be.
No, I see. Okay, yeah, there's an extension that you're bringing up that I didn't articulate, that I didn't fully get to. Yeah, one issue between materialists and post-materialists that I was trying to get at is that, yeah, it's really important to get away from this idea that not only can we control the world around us, but that it's something that we should strive to do, that it's the purpose of humanity in some ways to master and conquer the world. For lack of a better balance of evidence against that view, all we need to do is look at global climate change.
Exactly. You know, I was just going to say, like, Katrina, right?
Yeah, these are manifestations not only of situations that we can't control, but situations of, you know, this attempt to control that have
backfired.
Gone
backfired. Exactly.
So when you thinking about post-materialism opens up the idea that we can certainly maintain a deep sense of connection. We can understand the world around us. Science is real and can make sense of our world. But there are always things that will escape our grasp that are bigger than us and that require our humility and our respect and our continued willingness to investigate and corroborate with the world and with other human beings with whom we interact. And so, yeah, this ongoing need to be humble and to recognize that we're embedded in this world. And
not on top of it. Exactly. Not on top of the food chain, but inside it.
And this is a great place to be.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I even have drawn this out and put it in my presentations of a picture of a human on top of a pyramid, you know, with all the other animals underneath it, and then a circle with the human, you know, connected to the grass, to the clouds, and to the cow, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, we can drop that one now. I just needed to make sure we addressed it. You also, and I may be leading you in a direction that you don't want to be chatting about again, but how can we feed the world always comes up as, you know, I always get that question at the end of all of my talks, and I need to just head it off at the pass. And I thought you did a really, really great job of addressing that in the book in a nice short way. And I don't know if that's something that you'd like to discuss.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I'm glad you brought this up, because as your listeners may get a sense of from your introduction, this is one of the dicier parts of the argument, not because what I'm saying is wrong, but because what I'm saying is controversial. So one of the concerns that we face whenever we, whenever we face concerns about eating sustainably and not embracing conventional agriculture, is that we get confronted by the proposition that we need conventional agriculture, we need GMOs to feed the world. Let's just take that at face value for a minute. I think that there are reasons to reject that, but let's just assume that it's true. The question that I want to explore is not how should we feed the world necessarily, but what is our goal in this respect? Mm-hmm. My primary litmus test isn't how do we feed the world, but how do we maintain a world in which human beings can survive and thrive? Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, there simply must be less of us. And the reason for that is that with so many of us now, we're quite effectively converting the world's biomass into human mass, not only through having more of us, but given the ways that we consume. So surely we must change the ways we consume to be to maintain a lighter footprint. But there also need to be fewer of us. The response that I generally get at this point is, so what are you saying, that we should kill people off? And my answer is pretty simple. You asked me what to do in order to, you know, drive this nail into the wall, and I handed you a hammer, and you got mad at me for handing you the hammer. Mm-hmm. Not suggesting any specific set of policies. I'm simply saying that we're one part of the world's biosphere, and we're treating ourselves as separate from it, and making it our plate of food. And this isn't sustainable. In fact, arguably, we've already exceeded what I call biomass, or what one of the authors I referred to called biomass carrying capacity. Mm-hmm. Because we're able to feed ourselves quite effectively on the world's fossil fuels, which are ancient life. Mm-hmm. That's not sustainable. We know that's not sustainable. So even if our population were to continue to grow unabated, once fossil fuels run low, especially oil, the number of humans will begin to abate.
Yeah, I heard a nice analogy to this on a different podcast that I was listening to, but it was saying, like, well, let's say you invite, you know, five people over for a party, and they're all gonna spend the night at your house. And then you have 100 people show up, and everyone's like, well, how are you going to fit us all in your house? And it's like, well, I can't. It's not how am I going to arrange the beds? I just can't. I cannot have 100 people sleep at my house, you know? Right. I thought that was an interesting way. But so you talk about, we've got two issues. We've got, one is overpopulation, and then the other is overconsumption. And those are actually kind of happening at two opposite ends of the spectrum.
Right.
Yeah, so that we've got this overconsumption that's largely an American deal where we're just wasting, we're not only wasting food, we're wasting energy like crazy. And then we've got this overpopulation issue. And I loved, not only that you brought up, well, we need to educate women and get them contraception and try to have them, reproduce less so that there's just less humans. But you also bring up that that's really challenging when the status of women is so low and they're nothing until they get married. They're nothing until they have children. And not only that, they're nothing until they bear sons, preferably two or more, which is something that you really just can't sort of have some US foreign policy come in and just decree that that's how things are going to be from now on, right?
Yeah, and I think it's really important, the broader brushstrokes that I'm trying to provide here are to just hammer home that, we think of population concerns and population leveling and population control, how whatever you want to call it, as social problems, and we seek social solutions to them, including very good solutions, such as educating women and providing contraception. These things I would be in favor of anyway. But what we overlook is that these aren't at root social problems. They're biological eventualities, given the fact that there are excess calories available to us, we have more people. What I'm providing is simply what's called a systems approach to looking at these issues, and naming them as they are. That, we're biological beings; these are biological issues, and we can assess them and try to deal with them in social ways, but that may not get to the root of the problem. So, beginning to look at ourselves as biological beings, and that we're outgrowing our food source, may at least get us to focus on a more expedient way to address our population issues.
And then you talk about ecological farming techniques and just the plausibility of vegan farming versus pasture-based permaculture or animal-based permaculture, and what it might look like in England. You kind of bring up an example there of a couple scenarios. Which I love that you address that too, because I didn't expect it in a book about the moral arguments. So I was psyched to get to that point. Will you touch on that a little bit?
Oh yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. This is actually one of my favorite parts of the book. Yeah, writing a book that focuses on moral issues surrounding vegetarianism could have permitted me to leave aside these environmental concerns. But first off, I just was really interested in these issues. But the other thing was that the environmental concerns have their own sort of moral weight to them. To say that, okay, for instance, if vegetarianism is environmentally more sustainable than meat eating, as it's often claimed, then it seems that we have a moral duty on behalf of our environment to eat a plant-based diet. So I felt duty bound to confront this issue, and I was lucky enough to find work by a specialist in British or UK food systems named Simon Fairley, who did some very close grain, fine grain studies on the capacity of England to feed itself, and what that would require in terms of land use. What drew me to these studies was that my sort of central focus throughout the book became our connectedness to the land and our connection to food through the land, through the soil. And for your listeners, if you haven't looked at some of Diana's work on this, her writings on this, I really encourage you to. I had a chance to do so, and I see real resonances with what you're doing, Diana, and what Simon did.
So as soon as you sent me the link, I bought the book like in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And what's the name of the book again? Meet
a Benign Extravagance.
Yes, it's on its way.
And what he suggests, he argues that the United Kingdom can feed itself on a vegan permaculture organic diet. It is possible, but it actually isn't as environmentally sustainable as having what he calls animal-based permaculture, which at its root is what we would call small family farms that are connected to ethically, humanely run slaughterhouses. So instead of having conventional farming with these large agribusinesses running things, we have a model that looks a lot more like the United States and Britain, for that matter, 70, 80, 90 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that's when Britain and the United States just so happened to feed themselves. Mm-hmm. So, and what he wants to stress here is that in terms of land use, maintaining animals is actually highly beneficial, and maintaining just sort of a vegan approach creates real difficulties for those trying to do it within that ecosystem. I want to be careful not to generalize, but insofar as a lot of people who would be reading this book live in temperate climates, not exactly like the United Kingdom, but probably not a lot different either, there are ways to extrapolate what he was discussing to the places that they live. And that includes where I live in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you give very specific examples though, in the book. So you talk about, well, okay, how are we going to improve soil quality if we're not going to have animal poo? And so, okay, we're going to have to, on a vegan farm, we would need to have some cover crops dedicated to quote unquote green manure, which would be legumes that you would then break down and use to improve soil quality. But then you also say, well, what about fats? And so there you have it. So are we going to grow acres and acres of rapeseed to then extract canola oil from? Or you had linseed as another option, you know, because right now, if someone is vegan and trying to live a locavore type diet in, you know, the northeast of America or in England, they're probably eating a lot of avocados, a lot of coconut oil. So then you might say, well, okay, maybe it would make sense more than in a warmer climate, like, you know, around the equator. So then I started thinking, okay, well, maybe, you would certainly have a lot, you know, more mangoes and things like that. I have seen farms down there where vegetables definitely don't grow very well at all, because, of insect pressure, and other funguses that sort of just take over. And then, of course, we have to exclude all the dry desert areas because you can't grow, you know, water-intensive crops there because the water will just evaporate. So that, you know, pretty much takes care of all of Africa. And so what we're left with is, you know, pretty much, you know, the tropics. And, you know, but then you start thinking, well, there's a whole lot of worms and beetles and all kinds of stuff going on underneath the soil. How are you going to deal with that? Because those are animals and you are using them to improve the soil to grow your vegetables.
Yeah. Yeah. And with respect to the last concern, you know, I set that aside at one point, just saying, I know that any readers who are vegans are going to recognize that this is an issue, and their main concern, nonetheless, is
least harm.
Yeah, and yeah. What actually goes in my mouth.
Right.
So I the one issue that comes up in a number of ways, well, there are actually a couple issues, but one issue that you mentioned was the need for fats. This is something that's largely ignored, but it's obviously an essential part of any healthy diet, having good access to healthy fats. And you can have that in more temperate climates, but it's not easy,
right?
And it's not necessarily that effective in terms of available land use. Yes, so with vegan agriculture, you need to set aside some of the land for your green cover crops, for legumes or clover, these sorts of things that can be returned to the soil as nitrates.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that you can do in order to get fats is, to essentially make canola oil or linseed oil. Linseed oil, it actually doesn't taste very good, so it's not used all that often with cooking. So let's just stick to canola oil or what's called rapeseed oil in Britain. It's certainly possible to maintain one's diet with this, but converting the fats that you get in the seeds into oil is a pretty time and energy intensive process, and that's why our ancestors, at least in these regions, usually got their fats from animals, especially pigs. Pigs served an amazingly important function in their diets, actually, because they ate food scraps, and in times of feast, you could maintain your pigs, and in times of famine, you could eat your pigs because your food otherwise was growing scarce.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have this same capacity with other forms of fat, and this isn't a way to scold vegans. It's simply a set of ecological parameters that I ran up against time and again.
Yeah, and the land use as well. Okay, if you only have 5 acres to grow food for your family, you can, incorporate the chickens and the pigs within that and probably have a pretty sustainable little homestead. But if you're using, 2/3 of that to grow your fats, and then you've got your green cover crops, and I don't know exactly what the ratios would be, but you're definitely shrinking down your acreage for crops. And given that you're only eating vegetables, you would actually need, a lot more than an omnivore to just nourish yourself.
Yeah, and you can factor in also the need for phosphorus, which in animal farms comes with the folding of animals, allowing them to eat in pastures and then return to areas where you would grow food to, drop their manure.
Mm-hmm.
So what this suggests is that even in vegan farms, it would be really beneficial to have animals at least to maintain the phosphorus in the soil. But that would create a real fiscal strain on a family to have an animal that you would feed and care for, but not be able to use in times of food deprivation.
Right. Exactly. I'm really sorry that I have to go because I have I actually have a nutrition client in just a couple of minutes, and I wish that we had a whole nother hour to talk because there's so much more in your book that I loved. I highly encourage people to pick it up. It's called A Critique of the Moral Defense of Vegetarianism. Andrew, do you have a blog or any way people can follow you?
I don't have a blog. Ah! Should.
So they need to get your book.
I definitely recommend getting the book. Yeah. You can get in touch with me if I have a website through my home institution, Drexel University. But yes, a blog is something that I'm definitely not on top of at this point. So, yeah.
All right, and I need to talk to you more too about your quote unquote diet.
Yeah.
As well, because we didn't get to that, unfortunately. So let's set up another time to talk in the future.
That'd be great.
Okay. All right, folks. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And I will have a link to Andrew's book in the show notes. And we'll see you next time. Thanks. Thanks for listening, folks. And don't forget to visit me at sustainabledish.com to learn more about how to work with me, check out my latest posts, and visit my store. See you next time on the Sustainable Dish Podcast.